This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Philip C, and this is the Breakfast Grill. Today we have a special panel discussion on poverty eradication in Malaysia. On today's panel is Shireen Shariza Datuk Abdul Ghani. She's the CEO of Yayasan Sejahtera, and Datuk Dr. Ahmad Faizal Muhammad Perdaus. He's the president of Mercy Malaysia. Welcome both of you to the Breakfast Grill. Shireen, I want to ask you, many of us here have a certain picture of what poverty looks like, of what a poor person is. But poverty is definitely a multidimensional issue. So how do you look at it? And what are the areas and dimensions that we typically neglect?
Thank you, Philip. Important question. We all recognize that poverty is multidimensional now. It's not just the traditional image that we have of the person who is living in impoverished condition. There are also people who are facing various types of challenges that you can term as poverty, and that's relative poverty, right? If you don't have access to education, if you don't have access to, you know, opportunities and jobs to move the social ladder, those are also considered elements of poverty. And then we also talk about people with disability. So they also live in very challenging situations. And a lot of our planning, a lot of our programming needs to consider this very dynamic set of attributes that contributes to someone being poor, either poor of resources, poor of having no ability to move upward mobility in the society, even knowledge. You don't have enough knowledge to enhance your status in life and things like that.
And it's very hard to quantify many of these elements, isn't it?
That's correct.
And Dr. Faizal, we are at the midst of emerging out from the pandemic. Now, the government has a huge in-tray. They have so many issues to deal with, right? I mean, building a resilient education system, reviving the economy. So can I ask you, why is addressing poverty now ever more important?
Just to add on a little bit to what Shireen has just said, relative poverty now also includes people divided by demographics and by geography, which will mean someone earning a certain amount, living in a certain area, would probably not be in poverty, but someone living in the Klang Valley, in the heart of Kuala Lumpur, or in Penang, or in Johor Bahru, will probably be in poverty. So these are the types of challenges we face. And that is why, coming out of this pandemic, you could argue that eradicating poverty now is more important, if at least not just as important, an agenda that this country faced, perhaps not since 1970, in the aftermath of the 1969 unfortunate racial riots, which, of course, as we now know, looking back in hindsight, its major driving factor then was the poverty and the inequality in society. So now, coming out of the pandemic, we can see the impact of the pandemic. While the virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19, is sometimes an idealistic favorite of many medical practitioners, simply because it's so non-discriminatory in the way it infects people. It can infect kings and queens, prime ministers, ministers, and celebrities and corporate figures, as much as it can infect the poorest people on the street. So in a way, it's very equitable, if you know what I mean. It's a great equalizer. But after all is said and done, and while ministers and prime ministers have been infected, while corporate figures have been infected, after all that has been said and done globally and here in Malaysia, the worst affected segment of the community, either directly because they were infected by the virus or indirectly because of the economic impact, have been the poor, have been the B40. Why? Because this segment of the community, this segment of the population, is least equipped to be able to both get good access to good medical care, good healthcare facilities, etc., but also to sustain themselves as an aftermath of the indirect impact of the economic impact of the pandemic and the lockdowns.
So really a health pandemic to a pandemic of inequality. And I want to just cite a statistic that just came out that we have disproportionately affected the poor. And we clearly see that in the data because the income share of the bottom 40% of our population has now just fallen back to 16%. How does Malaysia fare in the world? And you were mentioning just now that inequality is a global issue, but has it been affecting Malaysia much harder than other countries?
Oh, yes, indeed. For three reasons. Number one, while we have an excellent both public and private healthcare system in terms of delivery of medical care, it's borne out by the fact that up till the latest surge mid this year, our public healthcare facilities, for example, our excellent Centre of Infectious Disease in Hospital Sungai Buloh, was able to keep our mortality or case fatality rate down to about 0.3% only. Yeah, before, of course, it's risen since then now to over 1%. The fact of the matter is, once the healthcare system was overburdened, once the surge had its peak in June, July, August, yeah, there you saw the drastic difference, yeah, whereby the poor had no choice. They still had only one place to go, which is the public healthcare facilities, yeah? While the upper middle class and the rich could still afford to go to private healthcare facilities. And so in that sense, people were left to fend for themselves. People were dying at home, yeah, etc., as evidenced again by the huge number of brought-in deaths, yeah, etc. The rich and the upper middle class survived that better, yeah? Now, that's a direct health impact of why... An example of how poverty affects even mortality and fatalities in the case of the pandemic, not to mention morbidities, yeah, not to mention illness. Now, the second bit, of course, is Malaysia has for a long time has had a Gini coefficient that is quite wide, yeah, which means that there is a disparity in income. Now, while governments, previous governments, prior to this one, to be fair to this government, previous governments, previous three governments now, have all been talking in different ways about Malaysia achieving high income nation status. But what does that actually mean? Yeah, it means that the mean income of our country is so and so. Yeah, the median income is so and so. But we know for a fact that for a large part of that high income nation achievement is actually propelled by the T20 having huge amounts of both income and assets, yeah? And so again, it's quite disproportionate. And when the pandemic hit, again, the T20 and the upper middle class were able to ride through the storm. They have savings, they have income still coming in, albeit perhaps slightly less, yeah? Although I would dare say not for all, yeah? But the vast majority of the B40 actually suffered. And not to forget, Philip, while you talked about the B40 having only 16%, let's not forget also that there were hundreds of thousands, if not millions, we don't have the exact statistics, perhaps Shireen knows better, of the lower middle 40, the lower M40, who actually fell into the B40 category as a result of this pandemic. And last but not least, why is this eradication of poverty so important now? Is because for us to build the resilience of both the B40 and the lower M40, we need to have a higher level of income and a higher level of safety, social safety net, especially for the B40, but also for the lower M40, should another crisis occur. And it may not be a pandemic only. It may be a purely economic crisis, yeah, which hits some of our important areas.
And I want to bring Shireen into this picture now. And you hit a nail on the head in terms of social protection because the EPF reported a 60% decline in median savings among its 5 million EPF members in its lower income groups, right? So the pandemic has clearly highlighted perhaps our preparedness or really the lack of in managing long-term disasters. Because let's be honest, Malaysia has done a great job in reducing poverty, but clearly the pandemic has shown that there are gaps in the preparation when these disasters take place. So Shireen, I want to get your perspective, right? Where do you think the gaps are?
Disparity of income and, you know, this multidimensional poverty occurs even in the most developed nations. Look at what's happened in the United States. The amount or the number of deaths were among the communities of low income and have very little limited access to healthcare and services. So it's a global issue. And you know, it's how the countries respond to it and how they actually craft the right kind of policies and intervention, working with all parts in the society, government, civil society, the media, individuals, right? So we need to look at that in a more holistic way. And you know, that Dr. Faisal touched on some data points that's come out from EPU, and I'll respond to your question about EPF. Our income level or poverty PLI has now been increased to 2,280. That means 5.6% of our households in Malaysia are in B40. And Dr. Faisal also said, you know, and rightfully so, that the M40, the lower part of the M40, has now moved into the B40. We know this. In public discussion, you know, people are talking about that. And it's actually about, 20%, the M40 moving into the B40 bracket. So it's about 580,000 people out there who have lost jobs, who have lost, income and all that, who has now, moved down into that category. So we don't have a B40 now. It's almost an inflated B60. So how do we actually look at that? Because, you know, when you lose the middle class, who actually are taxpayers, who actually provide certain kind of services, then it's difficult for the country to actually then build the economic strength, because the M40s are the one that are, consuming goods and services and things like that. So the economic impact is very, very severe, I think, if we don't look at M40 as well, who are not being addressed at this stage. There's a lot of programs for B40, and good, rightfully so, and we do that kind of work too. But I think the M40 needs some intervention as well.
On that note, we'll be back after these messages. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back on The Breakfast Grill today. Our focus is on poverty eradication with Shireen Shariza Dato' Abdul Ghani, the CEO of Yayasan Sejahtera, and Dr. Ahmad Faisal Muhammad Perdaus, the President of Mercy Malaysia. I want to just address this point about there's so many programs, because it's true, you know, there's a lot of programs with really good intentions. So what's the issue now at the moment? Is it that our programs are not designed well? Is it they're not targeted well? You were implying that they're too B40, perhaps we need to expand it. Or is it that the institutions that deliver it are just not equipped?
Well, there are three parts to that answer. Number one, I think this phenomenon of as Shireen rightly pointed out, and as I pointed out earlier, of the lower middle class falling into poverty, at this scale, is a phenomenon which this country and many other countries have not seen for a long time. The last time this happened was probably at the end of major wars, major conflicts. And we're not talking about localized conflicts. Yeah, we're talking about global conflicts, or at least pan-continental ones like the Second World War. The issue is also because as society is more developed and more sophisticated monetarily and financially now, while there are advantages now, there are also huge disadvantages. Because in the old days, 60, 70 years ago, you could plant vegetables in your yard, yeah? And at least that expense is off your budget. But for most people in the urban areas, the urban poor especially, there's no option of planting any vegetables anywhere because they live in flats. So that's the first part. This phenomenon on this scale has not happened for a long time. And it's even more difficult now because the needs, especially in the urban areas, are far greater than they were even 50 years ago. Like I said earlier, in the aftermath of 1969 here in this country. The second part of that, of the answer to that question, is the fact that, yes, you're right, programs have largely been built on the pretext that eradicating poverty means we go to the most hard-hit and poor areas demographically and by statistics. Yeah, that just doesn't work anymore post-pandemic. Because the areas now are not just confined to certain localities or certain types of occupation like fishermen, like rubber tappers, etc. They now involve a larger swathe of society, cutting across multiple occupations, cutting across different levels of income previously. Yeah? So what was comfortable for a lower middle income class family living in Seremban is going to be very different from a family living in a rural area in Ulu Tembeling, yes? But the loss of, say, TV, the loss of cable network, yeah, the loss of Wi-Fi for a family living in a city like Seremban or in Johor Bahru is a big impact on their quality of life, yeah? And then will also impact their ability perhaps to gain more income. And lastly, as both yourself and Shireen have perhaps implied, the ability and the readiness of organisations like Sejahtera, like ourselves, like also government agencies to come up with more wholesome and innovative programmes. And so, like Shireen said, programming has got to change now. It cannot just look at eradication of poverty from one monodimensional angle only.
And Shireen, your perspective on this, because if you look at the 12th Malaysia Plan, the government did talk quite extensively about how to address poverty. And one of their recommendations was to add more federal district level units to tackle poverty, right? Do you think that's the right direction? And, you know, what needs to be done differently? Because there are quite a lot of organizations already, both at the district and federal level.
If you equate poverty to pandemic, we are going to move into poverty being endemic. Think of that as a concept, right? The decentralized sort of approach is key because it needs to get to, you know, the communities and various parts of society. Right now, we're still doing centralized planning like we are not in a pandemic or not coming out of a pandemic. It's important for us to actually look at new solutions and more innovative ways to actually address the multidimensional and challenging complexity of people now falling into, you know, this poverty trap. And really, in terms of how the policies are being designed, we're using the same policies as we have done in many, many years. Central planning, same policies. So the expediency, we need to do it fast. We need to make it impactful and we need to make it, you know, relevant. That's not being seen as well as it should on the ground. I think good intentions, government, civil societies, that we all want to do the best for this country. I think we need to have thinkers who actually look at new solutions. We have to have execution capabilities that are fast and efficient.
So effective decentralization of action, that's what you're saying. But there is also a need to think about centralizing our information and database, right? Because we have so many databases out there that are duplicative and really ripe for misuse and abuse, isn't it? So how do you reconcile the need to centralize and coordinate information versus making sure that we decentralize action on the ground?
That's an excellent point. I think we cannot hoard data. Government also now needs to open up. We are all moving towards this movement of open data sources, right? We need to know where the hotspots are. And really, when we look at government and how you know, they collect information, it's very much siloed. They don't talk to each other either, right? So there's no, you know, consolidated data sharing or whatever within parts of government. So let alone us trying to get the right kind of information. So you're right, evidence-based, we need to have access to data, we need to have access to information, and that's where it becomes more effective and more targeted. Right now, it's not happening. You know, there's a lot of sensitivity about data on poverty because it also includes undocumented people. It also includes, foreigners who live in this country. So, you know, we're second guessing what's the best way to go without real evidence and without their data. So here's the thing about Yayasan Sejahtera, and I'm sure Masih Malaysia as well. We work on the ground and we collect the data and it's real. We verify, we go through the process to actually really, really identify what's the local issues there, and we respond to that. I think it works with NGOs. NGOs need to be given the capacity and be developed to actually be more effective on that, because we are the ones that's going to then bring up all these issues and all these data points that government can use as policy making information. So it goes both ways. It goes in many directions. We just need to do it in a more structured way, a little bit more structured, but open source. It's kind of the two concepts kind of like, you know, clashes with each other, but there's a way to do it. We're very innovative. We can use technology and various other tools.
So perhaps we can do it, but, you know, my niggling concern is that, do you think our problem here is that we politicize poverty? Because politicians don't want to let go of their own programs. They want to show that they dole out support. They want their name stamped, the photos taken, their legacies assured, right? So does that really stop in the way of a coordinated but open-sourced way of executing? And Dr. Faisal, I want to get your perspective on this because you see it as a third party from outside, right? That's a big problem, isn't it? Everybody wants to jump onto the bandwagon and politicize it.
First and foremost, we Malaysians have got to grow up. We have to stop politicizing everything and politicizing everything to the extent that we cannot move to do what's right. So, I mean, you can't avoid politics totally. Politics is, of course, everywhere in every country of the world. And it's not to say that Malaysia is the worst. It's just that sometimes we unnecessarily over-politicize some issues. And the eradication of poverty is certainly one of them. Perhaps 50 to 60 years ago, there was some justification for it because of the huge inequality between races, etc. But definitely not now. 60 years on, and especially with an event, a global nation-changing event like the pandemic having just hit us and hit our economy very, very hard. So that's the pretext or the preamble. I guess going into two of the details which I can offer is that number one, if we start to do this, as Shireen said, with open source and transparent data made available and with accountability from both government as well as organizations like ourselves and like Sejahtera and even the private sector. Corporations, for example, do huge amounts of CSRs, and they should be encouraged to continue to do so. If these can be done with transparent and open data available and accountability in place, I think we will resolve part of the problem. That's only one part of the problem. Now, the second part of the problem, like I said, we can't be too naive and be too idealistic and say we have to get away from politics totally in doing anything, not just in this country, anywhere in the world. But what we can do is be sensible about it, and where poverty affects actual living people on the ground, and both Malaysians, and I'm glad Shireen spoke about the non-Malaysians, which we have to acknowledge there are millions of them amongst us, especially migrant workers, but also a smaller number of refugees and asylum seekers. We have to acknowledge that it comes to them, it comes to the people on the ground, both Malaysian and non-Malaysians, we have to look at them with one lens. We should not be differentiating according to race, ethnicity, according to whether they are Malaysian or not. What we should do is look at how they are impacted and how the impact on them then impacts others around them. And so if aid is necessary to be given a lot more in area A, because if we don't, then the people there will get even poorer. And then we will have a higher rate of a crime, for example, emanating from that particular area because it's just next to a more affluent area of Kuala Lumpur, for example. Yeah, then we should concentrate some of our resources there. The age-old Malaysian way of doing it by looking at it from an ethnic, racial and partisan politics lines should not be the way forward. This should take a back seat, if at all. Yeah. So I think we have the ability to do so. We just need to move forward.
On a special extended Breakfast Grill this morning, we discussed poverty eradication with Shireen Shariza Dato Abdul Ghani, the CEO of Yayasan Sejahtera, and Dr. Ahmad Faisal Muhammad Perdaus, the president of Mercy Malaysia. When we come back, breaking that cycle of poverty and budget 2022. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to this special extended Breakfast Grill with Shireen Shariza Dato Abdul Ghani, the CEO of Yayasan Sejahtera, and Dr. Ahmad Faisal Muhammad Perdaus, the president of Mercy Malaysia, on poverty eradication. Shireen, how do we break that cycle of poverty?
Can I just share what Yayasan Sejahtera does? And we have this, what we call a graduation model. We take our communities from step one, i.e. having access to basic needs, water, shelter, food, right? Those are basic needs. Then we actually then provide the solution so that they are secured. You have to secure your basic needs. That's step two. Step three is that when you already have secured your basic needs and all that, now you can actually be empowered to look at choices, to look at other things that's going to create a better life for yourselves and your family. And the last step is actually a just and inclusive society. Okay, so it looks very ambitious, but having a framework that allows us to think through solutions and say, what do we do with their current needs now? How do we secure it so that then the communities that we work with have got those access to the opportunities? And then what kind of opportunities do we provide for the whole family? So how do we look at that in a holistic way? Bring communities out of. So in thinking about solutions for poverty, we can't just go into the very basic, like, oh, their roof is leaking, let's fix the roof. People like to do that because it's very visible, then suddenly the roof is good. But what happens in the next 3 years? What happens in the next 5 years? Have you invested enough to ensure that the children have got access to education? Is the family saving enough for their future? Have they got access to better healthcare? Those are the kind of indicators that we need to measure our poverty intervention now. That's where you're going to have success in breaking that cycle of poverty.
Because there's always this point that it takes a village to raise a child. You rightly point out that we need to nip it at its core and address childhood poverty. And with schools beginning to reopen, you know, how can schools and teachers play a role and really address the structural issues of poverty?
Nothing is more empowering than a good education, and social mobility is easiest and fastest when good education is available. Now, that's not to mean that that a formal academic education is the only way, but it is one of the easiest and fastest ways to ensure social mobility is present and is at least equitable for the most part. So if we want to achieve social mobility and if we want to increase the ability of children from all sectors, from all levels of society to actually have social mobility, we have to give them the opportunities to do so and according to their skills and capacity. So some will be able to go on and do PhDs, but we know that even among the most well-equipped, not everyone wants to do a PhD, yeah? And so for those who will do best with just a first degree, there should be ample opportunity for them then to train into their selected areas of interest post-degree, yeah? To be able to find work either the traditional way or the new gig way, the gig economy, yeah? Or being entrepreneurs. And for those who can't flourish academically, there should be more opportunities for people to do what is now called TVET, of course. But it's not just the TVET education system that needs to be reformed. It's the employer's market out there as well, which needs a certain amount of reform to enable people with TVET qualifications to go far. But this is still further away for us, yeah, especially in a more equitable manner.
You know, it's about basically placing dignity to hard work, regardless of what type of work it is in the first place. When you talk about shifting perceptions then of poverty, you know, Shireen, how, you know, what can we tangibly do as broader society to shift our mindset towards how we look at poor people?
I think you're right in terms of the dignity. You know, the people who are living in impoverished situation, they don't choose to be that way. They don't even want to be that way, right? So in the humanitarian world, and, you know, Mercy Malaysia, Yayasan Sejahtera, and all of us subscribe to humanitarian principles of maintaining dignity, right? So we have to think about it in that way and be very empathetic with our approach. It's about a sincere sort of approach to enrich thy neighbor, right? That very, very basic concept of humanity. And we do that in the best way that's possible because we want the best for each other. So we have to break away from that thinking of, oh, you know, that person is in such dire state, you must go out there and rescue them. It's not about that. It's about then looking at solutions that is meaningful and relevant and bringing them into being inclusive in how we plan and how we actually address their issues. They know what their issues are. We can't pretend to know what it is. Planning is very central, and the planning with communities, with the women in the corner who don't really speak up when, you know, there's a big group, but she has something to contribute in the discussion. How do you bring those voices into that dialogue to actually then have inclusive planning and providing the right kind of support? And it needs a bit of handholding. That I would submit. But we cannot pretend to know everything and we have all the resources to go out there and be the hero that we think we are.
And that requires, yeah, and that requires quite a lot of humility then, which then comes to my next question, which is there's so many organizations here on the ground trying to do excellent work. What do we need to do to ensure that they are run sustainably?
Number one, those organizations themselves now have got to look inwards and into themselves, yeah, and improve in all aspects. And one way is actually to do work more holistically. And in this day and age, you can't escape the two biggest challenges that mankind is facing. And I would suggest that that every organization take these two factors into account, which are climate change and the pandemic, yeah, and future pandemics. The second bit is the ability to do more long-term and sustainable work, and to look at things not with just a hit-and-run strategy. Even if the predisposing factor is an acute one like floods, yeah, you should actually try to look at how you can sustain aid and help beyond just the acute floods. Yeah. Last but not least is, and this applies perhaps more for organizations who are purely humanitarian like Mercy Malaysia or purely developmental as Sejahtera, is to look at what we now call the humanitarian development nexus and to actually combine both aspects of both the acute humanitarian basic needs aid, human rights, etc., but also the longer developmental aspects, yeah, not to underestimate the usefulness of cash aid in the acute situation, but like Shireen was implying, yeah, giving the man a rod to fish with is a lot better than just giving the fish, yeah. And so giving him or her, the family, the ability to eke out a new source of income, training them, giving them a new source of livelihood is probably more important. And if we go further than that, that's where the finance and financial institutions and organizations come into play, whereby financial literacy, the ability to manage your own funds, yeah, not to go into debt, etc., etc. All these things will have to be brought into the picture to enable people to have that social mobility.
Well, it clearly sounds like this is a marathon, requires a lot of effort from many parties to drive this forward. You know, we're going to announce Budget 2022 soon. What would you like to see in Budget 2022 that will address issues related to poverty?
I think, number one, the government needs to recognize the social sector as an important sector. Not enough investment that is being made to build capacity and build the capabilities of those in the social sector. But when disaster hits, then everybody looks at the NGO to go and do and deliver the work, right? Number two, the role of government, or at least in Budget 2022, as an organisation, Dr. Faisal is right, we provide the rod and, you know, we teach our communities how to fish. But hey, you need to create more pools where fish are flourishing. Otherwise, everybody is fishing from that same pool and we're back to ground zero. Policies and economic investments to create these new sources of economic activity. Number three is people with resources. Your corporate sector, they have resources that's not just financial, it's also talent, human capital. Invest in a mid to long-term community development program. Your one-offs, your, you know, going to just CSR. Give food aid and then forget about the community, your CSR does not work. It didn't work in the beginning. It doesn't work now. It's not going to serve us in the future. How do we tap on maybe tax, corporate taxes in a better way to actually then deploy it to you know, credible and good NGOs who can, CSOs who can deliver the services? And really, sometimes the CSOs, the CSO world, we cannot be sustainable because we cannot professionalize our people. We need training. We need skills. We need people who are professionals who run you know, nonprofits, so that then, you know, the outcome is better. But nobody wants to invest in the NGO. People want to just give, that's good, use the NGO as a conduit to do it. But we also need to be sustainable because then we need the support.
Invest and not just give. On that note, thank you, Shireen and Dr. Faisal. Today on The Breakfast Grill, Shireen Shariza Dato' Abdul Ghani, the CEO of Yayasan Sejahtera, and Dr. Ahmad Faisal Muhammad Perdaus, the President of Mercy Malaysia. I'm Philip C, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.